International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of cheeses, 25 kinds of olives, and 100 kinds of olive oil. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting every Saturday. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and at the controls this morning, Jason Croft. In this hour of Focus, we will return to the politics of the Middle East, a subject we have discussed many times on this program before. We try from time to time to include in this discussion different perspectives on the issues. Last week, for example, Natan Sharansky was a guest on the program. He was here in the United States to promote his new book about democracy in the Middle East. He has been for some 9 years now an important player in Israeli politics and has had several positions in the Israeli government, and he certainly has an expected kind of take on the issues that we'll be talking about here this morning. And in this hour, we have another guest that has a different kind of perspective. Our guest for this hour is Fawaz Jurjez. He holds the Christian Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. He is also a consultant, regular commentator for ABC News, and has appeared on many television and radio networks throughout the world. He is interested in Islam and the political process, American foreign policy in the Middle East, and the modern history of the Middle East, among other things. He's the author of several books, just to mention a couple, America and Political Islam, Clash of Cultures or Clash of Interests. That book was published in 1999, published by the Cambridge University Press. He has another that's scheduled to come out from Harcourt next summer, entitled The Jihadists, Unholy Warriors, and he's contributed essays and articles to a wide range of publications, Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Los Angeles Times, and many others. He is joining us this morning by telephone to talk. And as we do, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask is that people who are calling in just try to be brief so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible and keep the program moving. But, of course, anyone is welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. Also, we do have the toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Professor Jurjez, hello.
Hello, David. Many thanks for this kind introduction.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us your time. To begin with, let me ask you a very big question, something that I'm sure that we could talk about for probably the rest of the hour, but it was certainly one of the areas that we wanted to explore, and that is that what the possibilities now for the conversation between Israel and the Palestinians, how have things been changed or have they been changed by the passing of Yasser Arafat?
Well, I think we have heard in the last few weeks, I think there is a small window of opportunity for both sides for several reasons, David. I mean, I think first, now you have the potential emergence of a new dynamic Palestinian leadership, a Palestinian leadership that would put its house in order, that would invest in institutional building, that would nourish civil society, and that also, one would hope, would have a legitimate mandate from the Palestinians because elections are likely to take place in the next 60 days. Secondly, I think you have an American president with a second term, with a much more flexible mandate to take action and initiate policies if he desires to do so. And thirdly, I think you have an Israeli prime minister, that is Ariel Sharon, who has no longer any justification to use the presence and existence of Arafat as a justification not to engage the Palestinians politically. Because, as you know, the common wisdom in the United States and Israel in the last 3 years was that Arafat represented the major impediment to peacemaking between Palestinians and Israelis. I think, regardless of whether we agree on that or not, that's not the issue. I think since Arafat is not with us anymore, that particular impediment is not there any longer. And the question is, We'll see how will the three players, Israel, the United States, and the Palestinians, will act in the next few weeks and few months.
Well, as you say, Prime Minister Sharon, and I think probably other people in the Israeli government, had said that very thing that you said. They said, they have said that Mr. Arafat had been an obstacle to peace. It was not possible to talk with him as long as he continued to be the leader of the Palestinians. That was an obstacle to talks between Israel and the Palestinians. And not a lot of people have said, okay, now Mr. Arafat is gone. That obstacle is not there anymore. But one wonders, if you take a look at the Palestinian leadership or the people who you might think might be likely to move into positions of leadership, are there people there that you think the government of Israel would be willing to talk with? Well, or is there a possibility that whoever comes along that the government of Israel might say the same thing? They might say, well, no, we can't talk to this guy either.
Thank you, David, for this twin questions. I think the first question, it's a very critical point, because I think a new Palestinian leadership will likely emerge. And I suspect that Mr. Mahmoud Abbas, as you know, David, was a former prime minister appointed in 2003. And he's very much liked by the United States, in particular by the Bush administration. I think he appears to be the likely successor to Yasser Arafat. I am a bit skeptical, David, and I hope that your listeners will at least disagree with me. I'm a bit skeptical because I believe that we in the United States, we as Americans, we tend to exaggerate the role of personalities and the role and ignore what I call the role of systematic and structural factors. What do I mean by that? I mean, I hope I am wrong. I hope that history will prove me wrong. Regardless of whatever Palestinian leadership emerges, there is no Palestinian leader, David, who can accept Ariel Sharon's vision for peacemaking. There is not even a single Palestinian, not even a single Palestinian leader or opinion maker or civil society from the extreme left to the extreme right who would accept what Ariel Sharon has on the table. That is the shape of a Palestinian state. Of course, Ariel Sharon does not subscribe to President Bush's vision of a viable Palestinian state. He believes that the Palestinian state should be on less than 60% of the occupied West Bank and Gaza. No Palestinian state in East Jerusalem, the occupied East Jerusalem, and of course the right of returns for the 4 million Palestinian refugees is out of the question. And this is why I think it comes that, yes, we're going to have a Palestinian leadership, and regardless of what Ariel Sharon has or does not have in store for the Palestinians, it is their responsibility, their moral and legal and political responsibility for their people to put their house in order, to have a transparent and a genuine elections process, to receive a mandate, a popular mandate, and then to begin the process of engaging the Israelis. And one would hope that the Israeli public, would at least discover that it is their leadership, not the Palestinian leadership, who is obstructing the peace. And this is why, regardless of what we think of Ariel Sharon, it's the moral and political responsibility of the Palestinians to begin the difficult, painful, and complex process of putting their house in order, of having a transparent and genuine political process, and empowering civil society, and then the leadership of the United States becomes an issue as well, of course.
As you said, now we're anticipating that there will be elections for Palestinian leadership on the 9th of January, and a number of the Palestinian groups have said that they will participate. However, two of them, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, have said that they will not, and both of these groups have expressed some anger, perhaps, or disappointment, or at the very least to say they have chafed against the fact that Fatah, the movement that Mr. Arafat started, always was the ruling power within the Palestinian movement. And they say if Mahmoud Abbas becomes the head of the Palestinian leadership, then nothing will have changed. It'll just be the way that it was before. If you have an election but Hamas and Islamic Jihad don't participate, then what does that tell you about the outcome of the election and what happens after?
A point of clarification, David.
Yes.
Hamas and Jihad will participate in the elections. They will not have candidates to run in the election.
Ah, I see. Well, thank you for the correction.
This is a major distinction because and Hamas and Jihad are expected to also, have candidates for the parliament and also the local elections as well, because they have a more chance. Even if they have candidates for the president, I don't think they have a chance because they're power base in Gaza, not in the West Bank. But I think you're raising a highly critical point here. I think what Hamas and Jihad are saying is that we cannot participate, we cannot actually put candidates and be part of the government as long as the Israeli military occupation exists, and we do not accept the conditions on the table put by Israel and the United States. So Hamas and Jihad are saying, well, listen, while we wish you the best of luck, we would like to keep the so-called the military resistance option for us. And actually, it would have been wonderful if Hamas and Jihad would, participate in the political elections in January, because at least then they would have responsibilities to accept the popular mandate of the people. And then, of course, the consensus among the Palestinians hopefully would be enough for military action, and it's about time to reclaim the political struggle option, that is civic disobedience and political resistance instead of military resistance. But it seems to me that it all depends on the new leadership that emerges in the next few months and whether this new leadership will have the political will and the mandate to at least tell Hamas and Jihad, listen, that's it. The Palestinian people have spoken. The Palestinian people would like to chart a new course, a new mandate, a new paradigm, a paradigm based on political resistance, political struggle, not a military option. Because obviously, David, military resistance has not taken the Palestinians far. And in particular, terrorism has done a great deal of damage to the Palestinians, suicide bombings, targeting Israeli civilians truly have been disastrous. Disastrous not just for Israeli society, but I would argue disastrous for the moral case, the moral compass of the Palestinians. And I hope that the new Palestinian leadership, having a legitimate popular mandate, will tell Hamas and Jihad and also tell the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which is loosely affiliated, as you said, with Fatah, Fatah being the largest political faction in the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO. Listen, the military option is no longer viable. It's about time that the Palestinians utilize different means and different options to basically have self-determination and to rid themselves of Israeli military occupation.
And I wonder if I might ask you to continue to talk a little bit along that line, because I know this is something that you have written about and have talked about, and that is, and not just as far as the Palestinians are concerned, but perhaps with other Islamist movements in other places, that you feel that perhaps slowly but increasingly that people in those movements have looked at the tactics that they have chosen, and that they're beginning to look at the tactic of using violence, using terrorism, and saying this has not worked, and so we need to be doing something else.
Well, David, I would go further. I would go further and say even if those tactics work for the Palestinians, and this is, I think, there are some, as you know, there's a great debate taking place in Palestinian society, and unfortunately this internal vibrant debate, we don't hear about it because we know that the militants make a great deal of noises, and we, all of us here in the United States, we tend to focus on the noises, not on what I call the debate under the surface. I think many Palestinians are now focusing on the moral case, that is, even if suicide bombings work, that is, would bring about a Palestinian state, I believe that suicide bombings would ultimately devour whatever Palestinian society emerges out of the rubble of this particular struggle. So I think the Palestinians now and, you know, some civil society leaders, Arab opinion makers, are making the case that this is not only, even if it works, that the implications, the repercussions in the long term would be disastrous for the whatever emerges a Palestinian society and Palestinian state. And this is why I think now this particular debate that's taking place in the Arab and the Palestinian, even though it has not been decisive, even though that Hamas and Jihad still believe that they have a great deal of support among the Palestinians, because, David, what you need to remember, that Palestinian territories have been reoccupied in the last 3 years. Palestinian society truly is in a terrible bind. You have 80% of Palestinians in Gaza live below poverty line, 80%. 65 Palestinians are unemployed. You have a very brutal, repressive military occupation. And this is where Hamas and Jihad get their support, because Palestinians don't see, you might say, a light at the end of the tunnel. But the debate is taking place. And I think that's what we hope, that a new Palestinian leadership, either under Mahmoud Abbas or other, hopefully one would hope, a new generation, but basically would chart a new paradigm, a paradigm that's based on the political and moral will of the Palestinian people, that says, listen, military violence has not taken, military resistance, a military struggle, whatever you call it, has not taken the Palestinian too far. In fact, it has done a great deal of damage to the Palestinians. It has turned world public opinion, particularly American public opinion, against the Palestinians. It's about time the Palestinians reclaim the moral high point and convince world public opinion and American public opinion that what Ariel Sharon would like Americans to know, that his war against the Palestinian is not an extension of the American war against terrorism. This is an entirely different political situation. I think this is the challenge facing the new Palestinian leadership. And I really do hope, deep in my heart, that the new mandate, the new popular mandate, would enable people like Mahmoud Abbas to tell Hamas and Jihad, listen, that's it. The game is over. Let's begin a new journey, that would help us to get rid of Israeli military occupation.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Fawaz Jerjez. He holds the Christian Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College in New York, and is widely interviewed and quoted in both print and broadcast around the world. He's particularly interested in Islam in the political process, in American foreign policy in the Middle East, and Arab politics. We're talking this morning about particularly about what the passing of Yasser Arafat means for resolution of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, and perhaps we get to some larger Middle East issues as well. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm curious in having you talk about another point, and I think that it is the case that if you go around the Middle East and if you ask people, what do you think is the biggest problem in the region, they will say that it is the issue of the Palestinians. Now, whether Americans think that that's the case, that's maybe another question. But if you talk with people in the Middle East, they will say this is the most pressing issue. Let us imagine, and obviously this would be very difficult and long drawn out process, but if that could be resolved, supposing that that was taken off the table, what would that mean for politics in the Middle East
and
generally?
Between the Middle East and the United States. I think, David, again, another great question. Everything that we have done, and this is really, I'm not saying anything original here today. Everything, all our studies, and I'm talking about various political scholars, some of us who spend considerable time in the Middle East. I mean, I spend at least 3-4 months a year. Sometimes last year I spent the entire year in the Middle East. I spent 2 years between 1999 and 2001 doing research in the field. All our studies, the polls we have, show that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is one of the most critical issues that is obstructing political and socioeconomic development in the region, and one of the most poisonous issues in relations between Muslims and Americans and Westerners. This is, I think, it has become not just a hypothesis. I think it's a proven thesis. The importance of the Arab-Israeli conflict in Arab politics, within Arab politics, and between Arabs, Muslims, on the one hand, and the United States. And I think I would argue that 85% of the ill will that exists between that part of the world and the United States is a result of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and the widespread perception in the Arab and Muslim world that the United States has blindly supported Israel at the expense of legitimate Palestinian rights. I mean, this particular, regardless whether it's liberals or conservative or Islamists or nationalists, this is, you might say, the popular public opinion believes that the United States has sustained and maintained Israel's superiority over all the Arab states and particularly over the Palestinians. And this is why engaging in Palestinian-Israeli peacemaking would not only help stability and security in the Middle East, but I would argue would remove a major hurdle, obstacle, in relations between the United States and the Arab world, and would argue hammer a deadly nail in the coffin of militants like Osama bin Laden, like Abu Mas'ab al-Zarqawi, who use and abuse the existence of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict to recruit foot soldiers and suicide bombers to attack the United States and Israel. And this is why the vitality and the primacy of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, again, not just to regional politics, but also to how the United States is seen and perceived by Muslims all over the world. Mm.
Recently, shortly after the election, British Prime Minister Tony Blair was in the United States visiting with President Bush, and the two of them had a meeting with the press. And at that time, the president said that he believed that it was possible for there to be a Palestinian state by the time he left office in 2009. Certainly. And now at the moment, the current Secretary of State, Mr. Powell, is in the Middle East talking with people about the fact that they think that they do have an opportunity now, and calling on the Israelis to do everything that they can to make it possible to have an acceptable election for the Palestinians. I think for a long time, many people have felt that if there was one nation that could do something to try to move things along in terms of talks between the Palestinians and Israel, it was the United States. Now, however, during the time that President Bush has been in office, I think also some people have said, you know, the United States really hasn't done much. Do you think the United States really is in a position to make a difference? And what do you think the United States should be doing?
Well, David, again, another great question. Nothing could happen in terms of peacemaking without the actual intervention, not only the United States, but also of the president personally. If history teaches us any lesson about peacemaking, and we have worked very hard about this particular issue, is that presidential intervention is critical to nudging Palestinians and Israelis to the negotiating table. So this is point one. Not only the leadership of the United States, not only our leadership in peacemaking is crucial, but also the personal intervention of the President of the United States is the ultimate, you might see, key to unlocking the Palestinian-Israeli puzzle, whether it was President Jimmy Carter during the Camp David Accord between Egypt and the Israelis, or whether it was President Clinton, who almost, people forget, that President Clinton came very close at Camp David to really making or achieving a breakthrough between the Palestinians and Israelis, even though it did not happen. Both sides came very close. And the third point I would argue here is that this president, President Bush, came to office on the premise that he did not want to invest political capital in Palestinian-Israeli peacemaking. And actually, in the last 4 years, one thing this president has not done, he has not basically invested the precious capital that he has in trying to nudge Palestinian and Israelis. On the contrary, what President Bush has done, he has given Ariel Sharon, the Israeli Prime Minister, a carte blanche and accepted his claim that Ariel Sharon's war with the Palestinians was an extension of our war, that is, American war against terrorism. And this has done a great deal of damage, not only to America's status and leadership in the region, but also in terms of deterioration on the ground. I mean, Ariel Sharon has reoccupied most of Palestinian towns and cities. He cracked down brutally against the Palestinians. I mean, Palestinian institutions have been damaged considerably. I mean, in fact, destroyed. And this is why now I think we have a new chance. The new chance is that you have President Bush with a second mandate, with a second term in office. And let's hope, let's hope, David, and this is the question. It's not really, because the president has been saying for quite a long time that he is committed to bringing about a viable political Palestinian state. It's about time that this president translates his rhetoric into concrete political currency. So far, he has not done so. Arafat is out of the scene. Let's wait and see whether President Bush is willing to invest precious political capital. After all, he says that he has now political capital. We shall see if he is willing to exert pressure, not just on the poor and Palestinians, but also on our ally, that's Ariel Sharon, and convince and force Ariel Sharon to accept what I call international consensus. And we know what international consensus says. The international consensus says, and we are leading the consensus, the United States, two viable states live side by side in peace. And what I mean by that, it's not just a general statement, a Palestinian state on the whole of the occupied West Bank and Gaza, with, you know, you might say 2-4% exchange of territories, with its capital in East Jerusalem. This is what the international consensus, and President Bush has time and again said something and did something else in terms of settlements and so on and so forth. And this is why the world, not just Arabs and Muslims, Palestinians, the world, including our allies, Tony Blair, are watching very closely to see whether President Bush would basically translate his rhetoric into political reality. Let's hope, for the sake of Israelis and Palestinians, and also for the sake of our own vital interests, American vital interests, in the war against militants and killers like Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. In Urbana, here where we are, line number one.
Yes, I like much of what you're saying very much, and I, you know, certainly am in favor of a two-state solution, as you suggest. But one of the things that haunts this whole debate is the feeling that the Palestinians and many of the Arab states really don't want a two-state solution. Some Palestinians and some Palestinian groups state this very explicitly, that by the occupation, they mean the occupation of what's the current state of Israel, and they want one Palestinian state and not a two-state solution. This has been articulated, and the argument has been made that many of the actions of the Palestinian Authority of Arafat in the past, you know, have reinforced that notion that it's the Palestinians who don't want, in their hearts, a two-state solution. Could you talk about that issue?
Yes, I thank you very much for your question, because, again, this is the conventional wisdom now in the United States, and the conventional wisdom in certain circles in Israel. That is, the Palestinians, not just Arafat, the Palestinians are the rejectionists. Let's look at the reality. And I think I'm going to make some nonsensical points here today. Please don't take them for granted. The first point is that, yes, they are rejectionists. And the rejectionists are Hamas and Jihad on the Palestinian side, and Ariel Sharon and the settlers on the right wing in Israel on the other. These are the rejectionists. In fact, if you look at the political programs, and I'm actually actual, and we're not talking about rhetoric here, the political programs of both Hamas and Jihad on the one hand and Ariel Sharon, they really mirror each other. Ariel Sharon and his religious right in Israel don't subscribe to the premise or the notion or the idea of a viable Palestinian state or any Palestinian state, and Hamas and Jihad still hoping that somehow Israel would go away, would vanish, which is basically nonsense, because Israel is there to stay. These are the rejectionists. And what has happened, David, and this is really some of us students of Arab and Muslim politics, and I don't know why we have not been able to really elaborate on this particular point, is that a sea change has taken place in the Arab world in the last, I would argue, 8 years. In fact, as you know, 2 years ago, a major summit of Arab states, all the Arab states, met together in Beirut, and basically put on the table a new peace proposal. It says full peace, full withdrawal, Israel pull out of Arab territories, for full peace, including diplomatic, social, and economic policy. Truly, it represents a major sea change. And guess what? It was Saudi Arabia, one of the most conservative society in the Muslim world, that basically led the Arab team to put on the table a truly original a peace settlement based on full withdrawal for full peace between Israel and the Arab state. So the question to say, just to throw on the idea that the Arabs do not want peace, it's not just empirically it's not true. The Arab states have made it very clear. They told the United States of America, we are with you if you are willing to push for a peace settlement, a historical breakthrough. And yes, they are rejectionists. The rejectionists are not just the Palestinians. The rejectionists are Hamas and Jihad on the one hand and Ariel Sharon on the other. In fact, the majority of Palestinian society, David, everything that has happened since the outbreak of the armed Al-Aqsa Intifada in the last 4 years, despite the death, despite the destruction, despite the killings, a majority of both Israelis and Palestinians, more than 68% of Palestinians and Israelis still subscribe to a peace settlement based on a two viable states living side by side. It's Ariel Sharon and his religious right on the one hand and Hamas and Jihad on the other. The two religious rights in both societies, not just one party, as the caller said.
Do I have any more time?
Yeah, no. You go ahead. You can follow up. Sure.
Yes. I know that that there are two rejectionist groups: the religious settlers and these Islamic groups. I understand that, but if you ask certain questions, you know, if you look at it historically. I mean, in 1948, it was five Arab nations that attacked Israel. After 1967, when Israel wanted to give back the territories, Arab nations said no. In Camp David at Taba, where what was on the table was what you were proposing, and which I like, that is, a two-state solution, capital of East Jerusalem, following the borders, yes. It was rejected.
No, it was not rejected. Taba, it was accepted. It was rejected by Ariel Sharon in Taba after the Camp David. What you're talking about is that Yasser Arafat said no to the proposals put to him on the table by Prime Minister Barak and President Clinton. There was a follow-up. They met Palestinians and Israelis, the Labor Party, and Palestinian negotiators at Taba in the Sinai in Israel. And the Palestinians were all for it. It was Ariel Sharon, and this is the point I'm trying to make now.
Well,
it was Ariel Sharon and the religious right who basically said no to the Taba, because Ariel Sharon does not even subscribe to a Palestinian state on 60%.
Well, I agree with you completely about
Taba,
Ariel. I agree with you completely about Ariel Sharon, and about the religious right in Israel.
And both sides.
And I think they are rejectionists,
sides.
And I think they are. It is a terrible position.
And the point I'm really trying to make here is that, yes, you might say in 1948 the Palestinians and the Arab states made a terrible blunder. But, I mean, remember, in 1948, you might say, if you were a Palestinian, why would a Palestinian accept an alien state? Why would they accept, I mean, basically historic Palestine to be divided into two states? I mean, after all, there is more to the question of why the Palestinians did not accept the establishment of an Israeli state.
I just want to say one thing, that everything I have read, and I don't approach a millionth of the knowledge and experience that you have, but everything I have read suggests that even at Taba, it was Arafat who did not accept, who did not make any counter-proposals, who did not negotiate. That Barak was in favor of that.
At both
and
sides,
that I think is questionable.
By the way, please, if you just, this is not just my point of view. At Taba, the Israeli Labor Party, labor negotiators, and the Palestinians, both sides put on the table the proposal. It was a follow up to the Camp David piece, and it was accepted by both sides. I don't think that's a point. I'm making any point here. The Taba peace negotiations basically were accepted by both the Labor Party and the Palestinian team. It was Ariel Sharon from the Likud party who basically, and again, please go back and just check on this particular historical point, because Ariel Sharon, why should we give the Palestinians anything at all? He came on the premise that what Barak offered on the table was not in the interest of Israel. And this is why the Palestinians now, as you know, saying, we will go back to Taba. That's what, exactly what we wanted. But you see, the conventional wisdom now has it since Arafat was demonized so much, because everything was blamed on Yasser Arafat. This is not to say that Yasser Arafat was not to blame, partly to blame for what happened, absolutely. In fact, I would argue that now, that painful as it was for the Palestinians, I think the exit of Yasser Arafat from the scene provides the Palestinians with a new opportunity, an historic opportunity, to begin the journey of putting their house in order, of nourishing their institutions, of nourishing civil society, of creating a new leadership, and engaging Israelis seriously to reclaim what I call mainstream Israeli society. I think the challenge facing the Palestinians today is not just to convince world public opinion and Americans of their moral, the moral importance of their case, but also to convince Israelis to regain the trust of Israeli public opinion, mainstream public opinion, because so much blood has been spilled in the last 4 years and so much mistrust has accumulated. And this is the challenge facing the Palestinians and the Israelis the next few weeks and months ahead.
Hmm. Let me ask you this question, and it's something I've been curious about for some time. If we go back to this time and look at what was happening in Israeli politics at the time following up on Camp David, and when Ariel Sharon made his ill-fated visit to the Temple Mount that touched off the Second Intifada, at this time there was a struggle going on between Ariel Sharon and Benjamin Netanyahu for the leadership of the Likud party. How much of where we are now can be traced to that struggle between those two men for the leadership of their party?
Thank you, David, because I think this is the point I was trying to make, and when the caller called about the Taba agreement, I mean, I think the Taba agreement presented a major threat to the Likud party, because the Likud party's political program basically does not subscribe to the existence of actually they even question the existence of the Palestinian people, as you know. When Golda Meir, an Israeli former and late Israeli prime minister, asked after 1967 about the Palestinians, he said, who are the Palestinians? Who are, quote-unquote, who are the Palestinians? Because to the really core, hardcore of the Likud party, like Ariel Sharon and Netanyahu, the Palestinians basically are part of the Arab world. There is no such thing as Palestinian nationalism. And still today, the Likud party, some elements of the Likud party subscribe to the fact that there is a Jordan. The Palestinians should go back to Jordan, a neighboring state. There is no need to a Palestinian state. And you're absolutely correct. I think there was a major struggle for the soul taking place, for the soul of the Likud party. And the struggle is between two really, you might say, militants. You have Ariel Sharon and Benjamin Netanyahu. And both sides subscribe, you might say, to the same strategic existential goal with different technical, you might say, mechanisms. Netanyahu now is saying, listen, he will never accept the existence of a Palestinian state. Ariel Sharon, no, we'll accept something, a Palestinian state. We'll maintain the 280,000 settlers on the West Bank, no Palestinian state in East Jerusalem, no return, no right of return to the Palestinians. What he's really talking about is that little settlements here and there for the Palestinians. And yes, the struggle between Netanyahu and Ariel Sharon did a great deal of damage, not only to the peace negotiations between the Labour Party and the Palestinians, but also, I think, to the overall hope and goal and objective of reaching a historical settlement between Israelis and Palestinians. Hmm.
For the benefit of people listening, I should introduce again our guest, and we have some other callers. We have about 15 minutes left, by the way, in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Fawaz Jerjez. He holds the Christian A. Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College in New York, and has appeared on many television and radio networks throughout the world. He's taught at Oxford, Harvard, was a research fellow at Princeton. He's particularly interested in Islam and the political process in Arab politics, and also American foreign policy in the Middle East. lists among his books, America and Political Islam, Clash of Cultures or Clash of Interests, a book that came out in 1999 and one that's coming out next year entitled The Jihadists, Unholy Warriors. That'll be published, supposed to be published by Harcourt in the next summer, summer 2005. Questions welcome. We do have several people and we'll try to get everybody in the time that remains, and callers can also help us by being brief. We'll go first to Gibson City, and that is line number two. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello. Yes, go ahead.
Yes. Well, first I have a comment on the, I think the last caller, it's wondering why Arafat refused to the agreement that they came upon. And I've been to the, actually been to the West Bank and lived in the West Bank three times, anywhere from 2 weeks to a month. And one of the Palestinians told us, and I thought it was so good, I wish everybody could hear this. What was offered was 90% of the people, meaning living in the West Bank, the Palestinians, living there, but 10% of the people having the key, meaning the Israelis. And I don't think people realize that on the West Bank, the roads are controlled, and the ins and outs and goings and comings are controlled by the Israeli and the Israeli Defense Force. That's not the reason why I called. I called because I'm I believe in nonviolence, and I've been fortunate to see on the ground level peacemakers on both sides, Israelis and Palestinians. And my question is, how do you feel about the possibility of something happening like in South Africa, a nonviolent uprising, and, you know, the Palestinians getting their rights that way? And to me, nonviolence is the only way, and I just want to thank you for being on the program, and I really appreciate listening to you.
Thank
and
you.
I'll hang up.
All right. Well, thank you for the call.
Thank you for your call, and your really two great questions. I think all of us, really, Americans, Israelis, and Palestinians, would like one thing to happen, is that for both people, for both Semites people, Semitic people, to live in peace. I think it's a shame what has happened in the last 60 or 70 years between these two great peoples. And I think this is not really about scoring debating points. What we're trying to do is here is to try to do whatever we can to convince the United States, I mean convince our government, to invest precious capital in nudging both sides to the negotiating table. And yes, absolutely, I believe that military resistance has not taken both sides to the ultimate safe harbor. Let's remember, David, Israel has won almost every single war since 1947 against its Arab neighbors, with the exception of its war against in Lebanon against Hezbollah. Yet Israel does not have peace with the Arab world. It has, you might say, a military superiority over all the Arab states, yet it does not live in peace. It has not been able to translate its military superiority into political currency. The Palestinians, the same way, despite everything that they have done, despite the suicide bombings, the terror, everything else, the Israelis are not going anywhere. The Israelis are staying there. It's about time that both sides, David, recognize the humanity of each other. The Palestinian people exist. They are a nation. They are an imagined community. The Israeli people exist. They have their own state. It's about time that military occupation. I mean, this is amazing. I mean, South Africa was one of the, you might say, the second colonial experience or experiment to disappear. You have now the only colonial experience in the world, Israeli military occupation over the Palestinian people. It's about time that it ends. And also on the final point you mentioned, we talked, David, about elections. Let's remember, there are almost 500 military, checkpoints and roadblocks in the Palestinian, 500. How could the Palestinians move anywhere? How could they vote? This is why I think the United States, the Bush administration, is doing wonderfully in the last few days to exert pressure on the Israelis to pull out their forces from the Palestinian areas so the Palestinians can, move around and vote. And the Palestinians will not be intimidated by the presence of military forces. And yes, there is no way out of this particular deadly embrace except a political solution based on a historical settlement. Both people live in two viable states side by side in peace.
To our next call, it's someone on the cell phone, our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Thank you. I have a question, or I have a comment, and I'd like your reaction to that. The Christian Science Monitor a couple years ago made a statement that in the last 30 years, there's been $1.7 trillion spent on Israel and the peace surrounding Israel with the with some of the Arab states. Some of that money might have included a guarantee on the loans of and of the buildings that are on the West Bank, that if the American government has said that if they should default, that the that we will guarantee those particular loans. Now, my point is, why is the American government fueling such fire? If this much money is being spent, why couldn't it have been some of it spent to the Palestinians to ensure goodwill? And what's your comment about these particular bits of information? Thank you.
Well, I think, I mean, you're absolutely correct about, I mean, when we talk about the leadership, our the leadership of our government, that is the United States, we're not just talking about a rhetorical question here. We provide Israel with more than $3.2 billion in aid every year. Annual, I mean, this is big money. It translates to almost $1,600 per average Israeli, I mean, yearly basis. And surely we should have, I suppose, some... We can at least exert pressure in order to achieve a wonderful goal, that is the peace process. And I think the point is not just about how much money we give to Israel or to Egypt, but what this tells you is that in the eyes of most Palestinians, in the eyes of most Arabs and Muslims, American money, American weapons, American political weight sustains Israel's military occupation of the Palestinian territories. I mean, this is the big point. And this is why in the region throughout, I mean, that part of the world, people don't say, well, look, Israel does kill the Palestinians. People say American money, American weapons, American Apache helicopters, American F-16s. This is a reality, and this is why it's crucial that we, the United States, being the greatest power to exist in history, exert pressure on both sides, not just one side, the poor, occupied Palestinians, the victims, on both sides, and nudge them back to the negotiating table. This is not just in the interest of regional stability, as I said. It's the interest of our own vital interest, American vital interest, because we not only have one friend there, Israel. Our very primary interest, oil, trade, civilization, holy places, are all, I mean, intertwined in that part of the world. And now, of course, we have the war on terrorism. How can you win the war against Al-Qaeda and the killers while, I mean, millions and millions and millions of Arabs and Muslims see Israeli tanks and Apache helicopters bombing the Palestinians and brutalizing their lives? And this is why, whereby our leadership is crucial. Yes, we give money. Let's use our money and leadership to exert pressure on both sides and achieve a settlement, a lasting settlement for both people.
All right, we'll try to get at least one more caller. The next in line is in Urbana, and that would be line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello. I guess what my concern has always been is that in terms of the reaction of the Israel against the Palestinians, you know, a few people's lives are taken, then they go over and push over, you know, hundreds of houses and you know, kill 110 people or something. And the heavy-handedness, you know, in terms of their military reaction. So just like you to comment on that.
Well, yes, I mean, absolutely. I mean, no doubts about it. As I suggested earlier, I mean, really, we talk about the Palestinian leadership. Let's talk about the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people live under a twin, you might say, repression. On the one hand, they live between a rock and a bind, rock that is for Yasser Arafat, the corrupt leadership, and a harder place, military occupation. They basically cannot move from one village to another, from one neighborhood to another. You have military checkpoints, Israeli military everywhere, I mean, almost 500. You have on the West Bank almost 230, or some people 280,000 settlers in the heart of the West Bank. East Jerusalem has been occupied since 1967. Gaza, I mean, Israel has a carte blanche to do whatever it wants, send its superior military army, armada. that's basically mainly American, to bomb the Palestinians. Yes, Hamas and Jihad suicide bombings are horrible, awful, terrible. But again, President Bush, unfortunately, instead of trying to restrain Israeli Prime Minister and say, listen, you have to remember that at the end of the day, the two people must live together, basically he has given him a carte blanche, and he has accepted his premise that what's going on in Palestine and Israel is an extension of the American war against terrorism. It's nonsense. It's dangerous. It fuels terrorism. It supplies more ammunition to killers like Osama bin Laden and Abu Mas'ab al-Zarqawi. It's about time we use our leadership, American leadership, in order to exert pressure on Ariel Sharon and say, listen, enough is enough. Don't use disproportionate force. Don't brutalize the Palestinians. Your very actions produce more militants than you would hope for.
I think that we're at the point here that we're going to have to conclude because we've used our time. I want to thank Professor Gerges for being with us. We certainly appreciate you giving us an hour of your time this morning.
Thank you for having me, David.
Again, our guest, Fawaz Gerges, holds the Christian Johnson Chair in International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College in New York. And, of course, on future programs, we'll continue to discuss the issue. We will have different guests, different points of view, and we're certainly open to suggestions from people who are listening about programs that they'd like to have us do at any point, and we will do our best to do that. The broadcast today is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Art Mart, Art Mart Toys, and Boyer Drawing and Painting, producer of murals, scenic art, and faux finishing classes. The program also made possible by grants from 10,000 villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America. Tomorrow morning on this program in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be looking at a current controversy that's going on in our area that involves a deer hunt at Allerton Park. There is concern on the part of some that there are too many deer, too many for the environment to support, and also the fact that when you got that many deer in that sort of area, there can be very damaging. And so the university has decided to allow a hunt to cut down the numbers of the deer. There are some people here in our area that are very concerned with that and how it's being done. So we'll have a couple of issues to explore, some of the arguments, a couple of guests to explore the issue from both sides tomorrow morning on the show. In the first hour, we'll have Richard Warner, who's professor of wildlife ecology at the University of Illinois, with us here in the studio, and also Patricia McElroy. She is research associate at the Humane Society of the United States, and she'll be joining us by phone. And then the second hour, the guest is William Thomas. He is a physician, board certified in family medicine and geriatrics, and we will be discussing his recent book titled What Are Old People For? How Elders Will Save the World. That's tomorrow. We're here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, we hope that you will stay tuned because up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with Ursula Bacon. When she was 10 years old, she and her parents fled Eastern Europe.